Last May 23rd was a cold and windy day in the West German province of Bavaria, and somehow the bleakness of it was fitting for that day as Charlene and I parked our rented car in a public parking lot in Dachau outside of Munich and walked into the grounds of the infamous concentration camp of Dachau. We didn't say very much as we spent a couple of hours in the museum looking at artifacts and huge pictures, reading the lines of what happened there and elsewhere in Nazi Germany during World War II. The horrors of seeing pictures of families rounded up, having Stars of David plastered on them for an indication of their would-be fate. To read, as best we could translate from the German, the medical records of things that Nazi physicians did to other human beings, unspeakable things, indescribable, really beyond comprehension that one human being could do those kinds of terrible acts to another. And then we moved on outside. We walked around the grounds, chilled. I don't know if it was more from the wind and the dampness or the memory of what happened there. We walked after foundation in places where thousands, at points up to hundreds of thousands, of people were interred, all men at that particular camp. We walked to the far distant part of that compound where we saw the wall where men were lined up so that SS troopers could use them for target practice, and saw the ditch where their blood ran so that the target range wouldn't puddle with the blood. We went from there into the little building where we stood in the gas chambers. And outside of the gas chambers, looked inside of the ovens and the crematorium. And from there, we went back to the gate, kind of doing our journey in reverse, I guess. The gate where the prisoners first came when they came to Dachau. And there, lettered in the wrought iron of that huge gate in German, were the three words meaning work makes free. What a far cry from what work means for us this holiday weekend. For us, labor means a holiday. For them, labor meant a Holocaust. And then after standing by the gate and taking a photograph of it, we went back toward the parking lot, pausing for a while at the memorial that has been erected there, really a simple wall, not at all ornate. And there, written in four languages, including English, it says, "Never again." I wish that could be the way it is. I wish it had never happened, and that it had never happened before then, and that it could never happen again. That inhumanity against humanity could not be repeated. But the truth of it is, it had happened before, and if we sinners function as we have in the past, in all probability, it will happen again. For that was not the first of attempted Holocausts, particularly against Jews. The first to be recorded is that which we have read this morning from Exodus chapter 1. A story that Jews to this day look back upon as a turning point in history. A point of encouragement and hope that has taken those of the children of Israel through other difficult periods, like when Antiochus Epiphanes came across in the 2nd century BC and conquered Jerusalem and sacrificed a pig on the high altar of Solomon's temple. Or when Rome came with its iron heel and sought to crush out all of the people of Palestine. Or in the difficult years of the medieval church when oppression against Jews came in the name of Jesus Christ. Or during the Nazi regime. Or more recently, around the world and in our own country today. In times like these, Jews under persecution have looked back and read and reread Exodus 1 and the following chapters, and found there a lesson to remember, a truth for all times, the realization that God gives strength in the midst of life's bitter seasons. Actually, there are three lessons in that lesson in Exodus 1. The first you may think to be perhaps the strangest of them all. For it is in the first 7 verses that we learn the lesson that silence obscures blessing. This apparently was the time of God's generations of silence. I should tell you that in Hebrew, the book of Exodus does not read as it is translated here in English. Rather, it begins with the word and these are the names. And because it picks up where the book of Genesis left off. And then the list of the names of the sons of Jacob. A list of names that for every Jew hearing them then or reading them today is a reminder of the good old days. Those grand days back before the captivity. Good old days, you say? Good old days when they were then facing starvation. Good old days when they had to sojourn in a foreign land after being removed out of the land that had been promised to their father Abram. Yes, good old days. Not because of the starvation and not because of the migration. Good old days because those were the days when God spoke. Those were the days when God actually talked out loud to Jacob. Those were the days when they were starving and God brought miracles in order to feed them. Those were the days of promise repeated upon promise. And now had come the days of God's silence. Now had come the days when God did not speak. For 400 years they had not received a word, a syllable from God. And they could not help but wonder if the God who was silent was not a God who had forgotten and even forsaken them. 400 years had passed. You say, a little bit at least. I think I understand. Because I have also had seasons of silence from God. I have had those days, those weeks, those years, when I would have given every possession on earth for a word from on high. If only God had spoken to me. Maybe you have prayed as I have prayed in the midst of some adversity or difficulty. God, if only you would let me know that you're there and that you're going to see me through it. I can endure anything. You can take my life away, but God, let me know that you are there. And in response to that prayer, find only a silent God. Oh, we need to be reminded. We need to listen well. That the silence of God is like the clouds on a stormy day. Clouds that obscure the mountain range, but do not diminish its presence. Clouds that make it so we cannot see that mountain range, but do not make that mountain range disappear. In the times of silence, the silence is merely obscuring God's blessing, but the blessing has not disappeared. For them, God's blessing in those generations of silence was a blessing of growing strong. In verse 7, we read that the descendants of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew strong, so the land was filled with them. Do those words have a familiar ring to them? If you are, as I, having attempted to read through the Bible on numerous occasions and having read the opening chapters of Genesis more than the rest of the Bible, because I never quite make it through and vow to start again the next year, then you may recall that those are almost the precise words that were used in the Garden of Eden in Genesis 1:21, where God commanded Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Or maybe you remember, if you made it to Genesis 12, that in Ur of the Chaldeans, God gave a promise to Abram. And said, I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and will make your name great so that you will be a blessing. You see, it was during those silent years that God was not only blessing, but that God was making his promises come true. It was during those 400 silent years when they wondered if God had forgotten or forsaken them, that God was making them fruitful, that God was multiplying them, that God was making them into a great nation just as he said that he would do. And that is precisely what God is doing for us in our seasons of silence. He has neither forgotten nor forsaken, but he is making us strong and making his promises come true. On the 17th of July, this past month, while doing what I thought was a rather routine task of replacing a pane of glass on a cottage window, I slipped while trying to pull out a rusty old staple with some needle-nose pliers, and my left hand went flying, and although I had thought I had set the new pane of glass at a safe distance of a foot and a half or 2 feet, it apparently should have been farther away, because my hand went up against the pane of glass. Didn't hurt the glass, but to my hand, it cut the skin and severed the tendon and cut into the bone. I knew immediately I was in trouble, substantiated by blood all over the glass. Charlene and Brian and I then got in the car and hurried to the closest hospital, St. Joseph's Hospital in Brainerd. We need not have hurried. It took 4 more hours before we got the orthopedic surgeon there. So I read the Brainerd paper. I read USA Today. I had plenty of time. There was no rush at all. He determined that I needed surgery, and that involved keeping me overnight in the hospital and all of that. It was interesting. It was not terribly painful. I woke up after the surgery, and to my surprise, my hand had been replaced by a brown cast. And it was fun to talk to the nurse about it, and I had never had a cast before. I'd never had a broken bone. And I took a certain, I wouldn't say pride or delight, but whatever some synonym in Roger's thesaurus would be. It was interesting to have all of the attention, frankly. And the friendly people of central Minnesota asked all kinds of questions. Everywhere we went, people said things like, "Did you hurt your hand?" Always wear a cast, you know, like Michael Jackson. I sort of have my glove that covers up my left hand. And even going through the drive-through at McDonald's, you know, to get an ice cream cone, you give them the $39.41 with tax. The gal said to me, "What happened to your hand?" And it was fun at first, and then it started to swell and itch. And I was working on a word processor, doing some writing projects, sometimes working 6, 8, even 10 hours a day with one hand and one finger working on this thing as everybody else was out in the lake swimming and screaming and water skiing. And they invited me to come as an observer on the boat, which I did appreciate, but it wasn't all that much fun. Now, after 2 weeks of this, I was ready to have the cast off and see my hand again, which I had missed over that 14-day period. And I went to the doctor, and he was supposed to examine my hand. I really don't understand that because he couldn't see it. It was in a cast. And he then said, "Well, 2 more weeks in the cast," and sent me back home again. Turned out he was on vacation 2 weeks later, so I had to find somebody else to take the cast off. And it was during those remaining 2 weeks that I counted the days, if not the hours. When the cast came off, the hand didn't look very good and didn't work very well, although now full dexterity has returned. And I found that during that time when I could not see my hand and it was covered up, it was growing strong. And the doctor's promises were coming true. He explained to me last week when I went back for another visit that tendons are something like bones, that where they have been hurt and where they heal, they are even stronger than the rest of the tendon, as a bone is stronger at the place where it has been broken. And that now, because of those 4 weeks in a cast, when it was strengthened and when his promises came true, now I am able to type and water ski and do all of the things that a left hand is supposed to do. It was during the time of obscurity that the strengthening came and the promises were fulfilled. It's the same way God does it. Do not think because you are in a season of silence and God does not speak to you that he is not there. For it is precisely in the silence that the blessing is obscured, and he is making you strong, and his promises come true. Now, there is another lesson in verses 8 to 14. It is the lesson, also a strange one, that blessings often provoke adversity. The blessing of God, which brought the Jews to Egypt, was there turning them into a great nation, but that turning them into a great nation triggered the adversity of injustice. You see, a new king had come along, a king that didn't know much about Joseph. Now, we may say, how could that possibly be? And we may want to indict that new pharaoh. Before we indict him, we ought to tell a little bit about what we know of prime ministers who served 400 years ago. Most of us, even if we have studied them, don't remember what we studied. For that pharaoh, he was about the business of running a nation, a great nation, an empire almost. And because of all of the things that were happening, of course he didn't know about Joseph, nor did he particularly care. He was threatened by the presence of 3 million aliens who were within his borders, a particular difficulty for him. But that was not the fault of the Jews. Their forebear, Joseph, had given marvelous, exemplary, exciting leadership at a troubled time and had saved the nation from starvation. And then, as the nation grew from 70 to 3 million, they had faithfully served the Egyptian dynasty. So much of the prosperity that had come to the Pharaoh was a result of that which the Jews had performed. But that didn't seem to make much difference. They became the victims of injustice, as often people become the victims of injustice. I know many. I think of a man who worked his entire career for a company. And then a new boss came and he lost his job not too many years short of retirement. An awful injustice. I can think of too many instances of husbands or wives who have been faithful and diligent and, from my vantage point, exemplary in their marriages, only to discover one day that husband or wife has walked out of that marriage for someone else. I can tell you of people who in their own businesses have sought to have their businesses represent Jesus Christ and do everything according to the precepts of Scripture, only to become entangled in a sticky lawsuit where everything is lost and the company goes down the drain. Injustice. Just like the Jews, we know something of what that injustice is. We need to remember that God's blessing in the past is not a guarantee that we will be trouble-free in the present. It's true that often God's blessings are wrecked by those who pervert justice and exercise injustice that becomes adversity. But worse yet for those Jews. Being forgotten, they thought, perhaps, by God, was bad enough. But the blessing of God, which increased them from 70 to 3 million, provoked further adversity, the adversity of oppression. Pharaoh was greatly threatened by these foreigners, probably for what seemed to him to be good reasons. In the history of ancient Egypt, there was one dynasty after another. We don't know precisely when Exodus 1 occurred. One possible guess is that it was somewhere in the mid-16th century BC. If that is correct, it was at the end of a time when there were foreign dynasties for several hundred years ruling Egypt, Asians that had invaded and set up their own pharaohs. And it was only about the time of Exodus 1 that Amos, a new pharaoh, was able to overthrow the Asian Hyksos dynasties and establish at last, and again, an Egyptian dynasty. You would expect then that he would be particularly concerned about having in his borders a large nation of people who had come from Asia, who might try to overthrow his throne, or at least, if there was another invasion from Asia, would side with the invaders instead of with the Egyptians. His remedy was oppression. He would try to stamp these people out. As he did that, God blessed them more and more with further multiplication. Now, the average guy out working in the ditches in the fields didn't seek that kind of blessing. He was in the baking hot sun of the Sahara region of Africa. He had taskmasters who were leaning on him heavily, extending expectations far beyond what they should be. He was ready to wilt. He was blistered. He was broken. He was pleading with God for some type of intervention which did not come. And as he pleaded with God, just what he needed was to come home at night and have his wife say, "Honey, I'm pregnant again." And that is precisely the blessing that God gave. He wasn't looking for another baby. He had too many babies already. What he was looking for was some relief and some release. But that wasn't the blessing God gave to him. I suppose the lessons are for today as well. That many times in the midst of our adversity and difficulty, we expect a certain type of lesson or blessing from God that we prescribe. And we say, "God, this is what I want you to do." And God blesses us in a way that we may sometimes consider to be anything but a blessing. It is then that we must remember that blessings at times do provoke adversity. I could tell you the story of a Wooddale family where shortly after the man came to know Jesus Christ as Savior was when seemingly everything started to go wrong in his business and parts of his personal life. The blessing that God gave him triggered other things. I can tell you stories, or you can tell me the stories of blessings that have come from God and successes which have brought up critics that were not previously there and oppositions which would not have been present had the blessings and the prosperity not come. That's why lesson number 2 must tie up with lesson number 3 in the final verses 15 to 22 of this chapter. The third lesson is that adversity creates opportunity. And that opportunity can go either way. For Pharaoh, it was an opportunity, at least as he took it, for sin. Now let's not minimize that he faced adversity. His Jewish problem wasn't getting any better. It was getting worse. And everything he tried seemed to fail. What he should have seen was God's hand of blessing upon God's people. And had he seen that, he would have had an opportunity for righteousness. But instead, he saw it as an opportunity for sin. He had a triple strategy. Strategy number 1 was to work the Jews to death. But they didn't die. When that strategy failed, he switched to strategy number 2. Strategy number 2 was to order the midwives to murder all the boy babies. Now, the logic of that was that if the boy babies were killed shortly after birth, then they would not grow up to be soldiers. And if the girl babies were allowed to live, then they could be added to the harems of Egypt and eventually would be processed into the nation and Israel as a nation would disappear. So, in verse 16, we are told a little bit about the culture in reference to the birth stool that was a pair of stones where women squatted as the child was born. Midwives were brought in and they would assist in that birth, and then it was their responsibility to cut the umbilical cord, determine the gender of the child, and then they would go to another room separate from the birthing room where the husband was distraught and waiting for the news, and all the rest of the family is there also waiting for the news, and she would then announce the gender of the child and perhaps present the child to the rest of the family. What Pharaoh was doing was asking that between the time when the mother was on the birthing stool and the time when the announcement would be made to the rest of the family, if it was determined to be a boy baby, the baby was to be killed. And then when the midwife would go and talk to the family, she could announce that the child died somehow in conjunction with the birth. That strategy also failed. So he had another backup, a third strategy, and that's in verse 22. Pharaoh commanded all his people to kill all the boy Jewish babies. To take a phrase out of Hitler's vocabulary, this was his final solution to the Jewish problem. He moved from the taskmasters, few, to the midwives, more numerous, to eventually recruiting the entire nation to wipe out all of these Jews. It was a tragic mistake, a mistake that he bitterly learned during the 10th plague that was to come, when his own son was killed in the plague. It was a tragic lesson because all of the nation of Egypt had been recruited into this genocide, and all of the nation of Israel in that last plague lost a firstborn from every family. Yes, Pharaoh faced adversity, and he used it as an opportunity for sin. But there's another story in here, and that is the story of these Hebrew midwives. They also faced adversity. They had to choose between obeying the law and life. They had to choose between the fear of God and the fear of Pharaoh. And frankly, the choice is similar to that that is faced by Christian nurses and others in the medical profession today. Have you followed the lawsuit that is going now through the Florida courts that began with a failed abortion at the Plantation General Hospital in Broward County, Florida? The fetus, the child, lived by mistake, lived at least into the next day. And the nurse, the neonatal unit, who insisted on intervening and wanted to provide life support so that that child could live, was ordered by physicians and hospital administrators to let the child die, and because of her disobedience, was discharged from her employment, and now a lawsuit has become involved. I'll tell you, I read something like that, and I read Exodus 1, and I'll tell you that in my opinion, the only difference between modern America and ancient Egypt is the magnitude of the sin. And if my guess is right, not even ancient Pharaoh would have authorized the slaughter of 1.5 million babies in his country every year. Two midwives are singled out, and I don't know why their names are listed, Shiphrah and Puah. Their names, when translated into English, Shiphrah means beauty, and Puah means splendor. Here, amidst great adversity and formidable threat, they chose righteousness. If it meant defying an empire, if it meant disobeying the king, if it meant they lost their lives, they did not care. They chose that opportunity would be an opportunity to do right. Hey, look, we all get opportunities. We'll have them this week. Some of us will get these kinds of opportunities today. In hospitals, in school classrooms, in our places of employment, in our neighborhood, in our family. Opportunities that we can take either way. An opportunity to sin or an opportunity for righteousness. Some will choose the opportunity for sin. It might as well be named Pharaoh. And some will take it as an opportunity for righteousness and ought be called Shiphrah and Puah, beauty and splendor. Now, all things considered, I don't think that life is a great deal different in modern America with our skyscrapers than it was in ancient Egypt with its pyramids. We all have our bitter seasons. Seasons when we think that God has forgotten or forsaken us. Don't be so mistaken. God's silence may obscure the mountains of his blessing, but those blessings are still there. He is making us strong and his promises come true. Out of his blessing indeed may come adversity, but be assured for us as well as for them that the lessons are true for today, that adversity will bring opportunity, and we will choose if it is an opportunity for sin or an opportunity for righteousness to live in the power of God through Jesus Christ. Let's stand to pray. Gracious Father, I pray especially today for those here in our midst who need your special strength for bitter seasons, those who are hurting, those who are broken, those who have not the strength or the hope to go on for another day. I pray, Lord, that in the midst, perhaps even of your silence, you will pour upon them all of your blessing, make them strong, and your promises come true, and give to them great opportunities for righteousness. For Jesus' sake, amen.